As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hi, hello. Thank you for tuning in to this week's Athletic Football Tactics podcast, where we dig into tactical and technical aspects of football. And today, well, I think a little bit of both. It's time to have a definitive conversation about dribbling. This will be partly a technical discussion about the different meanings within that catch-all term dribbling, but also how to measure dribbling quality, and a discussion about the increase or decrease of the importance of dribbling and its specialists in elite football tactics. Sounds pretty good, right? Joining us today is Mark Kerry, PhD. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Ali. How are you?
Well, Liam Tharm, MSc. You all right, Liam?
I'm good, thank you.
And Michael Cox, best-selling author. How about that?
Yeah, it sounds less impressive than three official letters, but thank you.
I'm just Ali, and I think that dribbling, personally, is a really general word, and I think there's a ton of nuance within that. So, Michael, let's start by trying to define what we mean by dribbling. What does it mean to you?
It's a good question. I mean, when you read historical accounts of football when it was first formed, dribbling basically was football. Like, that's what the game was. I think it's basically comparable to almost like the pattern of a rugby league game. Like a player would get the ball, they'd dribble it forward, they'd get tackled, someone else would pick it up and dribble the ball forward. Like, passing wasn't that much of a thing. So yeah, initially it was a dribbling game. What does it mean? I would say dribbling for me is just the art of running with the ball. And I think it's quite interesting. I've seen on Twitter and on the internet recently, for example, I would say he dribbled past the fullback. And I've seen some people just say he dribbled the fullback, which I don't know whether that's an Americanism, but I do think it actually slightly shifts what the word dribbling means. To me, it's just running with the ball. It's not necessarily going past someone. But I think maybe the concept of going past someone and the concept of just dribbling has become a bit conflated now.
Yeah, I largely agree with Michael. I think it's become quite an umbrella term. It's always sort of to do with some form of pressure, I think. Now you can sort of delineate between the idea of a take-on, so actually going past a player or multiple players. And we've now got the rise, I think, and this tends to be more sort of relative to how far you're carrying a ball in terms of like a progressive carry. So actually moving the ball forward, not necessarily beating a player directly, but you might be trying to drive between defenders. So I think, yeah, it's the whole art form and you know, however you want to describe it, of moving forward with the ball at your feet. But I think it's become, as we'll get on to, as much of a tactical thing now about doing it to get upfield, to find space and to pick lock a press than it is just in terms of directly 1v1 duels. And I guess that's when we got into the data and how you define that gets quite complex.
Yeah, I don't know whether the evolution of, you know, the use of data and the criteria that's then subsequently used has also informed the way that we think about it, because I guess in order for data to be collected accurately, and I suppose there are different data providers, you need to have a fairly strict criteria of what constitutes a dribble, or as the guy said, a take-on or a ball carry. So opt to define a take-on, or they say a take-on or a dribble, as an attempt by a player to beat an opponent when they have possession of the ball. So it's pretty straightforward, but I think to Michael's point about it sort of running with the ball, in the at least in the criteria of the data, that would constitute a carry in this instance, where a carry here is defined as any movement of the ball by a player which is greater than 5 meters from where they receive the ball. So I guess in broader terms, a take-on or a dribble is very much a duel that is contested. It's a 1v1 or potentially a 1v2 if the opponent's doubling up, and a carry is essentially uncontested. And we can sort of look into the further nuance of that across this episode.
Absolutely. And Michael, when I think of the word dribbling and dribblers in particular, historically, I think of tricks, of skills, of famous players who were able and had the confidence to try tricks and skills that we would then all try and replicate on the playground and fail miserably. I mean, to what extent for you are tricks part of the discussion of dribbling?
Yeah, maybe not so much anymore. I think a lot of the kind of classic Ronaldinho skills to get past a defender, I do think he needed quite a lot of space to do a lot of that stuff, whether it was the Elastico or Cristiano Ronaldo had that thing where he used to kind of really chop inside quite dramatically. I think a lot of those, the game's so compact these days that it's quite difficult to do. And yeah, I think there's also, it tended to be that it was younger players who would do those kind of things and probably do them less as they get older. I think, again, Ronaldo being the best example of that. But it seems to me now that players emerge as quite mature. You know, you look at, for example, Saka and Martinelli for Arsenal, both very young players. But I don't really think of them as doing tricks or doing skills. I think of them as just very direct and purposeful and obviously offering lots of end products. So, yeah, maybe that has slightly gone out of the game.
Messi. Oh, brilliant skill from Lionel Messi. Surging forward with real menace here. Brilliant from Messi. Oh, what a goal that is! And the whole of this ground stands and applauds the 19-year-old. Have you seen a better goal than that anywhere this season? I very much doubt it.
Yeah, Ronaldinho is, to be honest, the name that always springs to mind when I think of dribbling and in particular skills and tricks. I suppose Neymar in the more recent generation would be his heir on that front. But what about someone like Messi, Michael, who is amazing really because one of the best dribblers of all time, absolutely no doubt about that, but really had almost no tricks that he would whip out. It was just about, well, agility, balance, ball control, the intellect to know how to shift your weight to throw defenders off balance. It's all about that with Messi.
Yeah, probably a bit of a generalization, but I think of Brazilian players as doing tricks, and I think of Argentine players as kind of tricking their opponent, if that makes sense.
Nice. Like
not actually doing skills, but just doing something to throw them off balance. And I must say that's something that I never really considered until, I kind of watch videos or listen to players talking about dribbling. And there's actually a really good Messi video that's must be from over a decade ago. From his formative years at Barcelona, because he's, you forget what he looked like. Like, he looked quite like scruffy with his long hair and stuff. But anyway, there's this video where they're playing on what I think is the old mini estadi next to the Camp Nou. And he's just talking, us, the viewer, through what he does when he's dribbling and how he's trying to throw the defender off balance. And this might sound silly, but when I was like younger and playing football, I don't really remember coaches talking about that. Like when it came to dribbling, it was just like dribble through these cones. And that's what you did. Like you just dribbled round things. You didn't necessarily think about your opponent and really trying to put them off. But that's obviously a fundamental part of it. And I think that's why players can do things in tighter spaces now. It's not just about weaving round. It's about, throwing them off balance. And actually, I did one of our My Game and My Words series yesterday with Andrei Shevchenko, and it includes a really good goal he scored against Bari where he dribbles past a couple of players. And there's a great example of that where it's not really a step over, it's just a feint to just throw the defender the wrong way, and then he accelerates into the space. And just little things like that is obviously so important.
You typically think of it as kind of a trajectory thing, to your point, Michael, about it going in different directions. I think that was something that Messi was and still is really good at. And in the Premier League, I'd maybe say Karim Mitoma is probably the best example of that, of shifting the weight of the opponent. And I know from interviews actually on site that he said as much, that that's where he feels that he can get the most advantage. But yeah, it's another thing of the sort of the criteria or definition of a dribble is that you typically think of it as going maybe left, right, or different directions. But a dribble could actually be continuing on the same path, trajectory, but actually moving the opponent from side to side and continuing on. And that's credit to the skill, the dropping of the shoulder, the balance, the agility of the player themselves.
I wonder if there's a sort of wider cultural point to lean on from what Michael was saying about the difference between sort of Brazilian and Argentinian players, that I think there's maybe fewer players now that seem to come through playing futsal or doing other sports. There seems to be a lot more sort of early specialisation in football, particularly in England now, with academies recruiting players as young as they do. Players are either sort of not quite discouraged, but they just simply don't have the time or the availability or the fitness to do so many things on top of it. And I think whenever I've watched futsal and you watch the way that they play on a smaller sided game with a ball that stays on the floor more and a smaller pitch, that effectively becomes a game of 1v1 duels. And I think that then maybe creates a different type of player technically in smaller spaces. Whereas now we're talking about dribblers who really have all got an awful lot of speed as sort of their main component, would be the one thing that unites them all. And then maybe they interpret that slightly differently in terms of what they do with the ball.
Really interesting. Mark, one of the things that we really like to talk about on this pod is the extent to which we can measure things that happen on a football pitch with granularity and with accuracy. Where do you think we're at in terms of being able to measure dribbling and the quality of dribbling and the value that dribbling adds using data, and how much has that changed over the last decade or so?
Yeah, I think it's a good point in terms of the quality and the value of the dribble, because you know, you could have a player who's dribbling loads but not actually sort of being productive, maybe even dribbling and moving the ball further back. So I think if you were to maybe look at what the criteria might be, you'd look at multiple things. You'd maybe look at whether the dribble itself was in a central or a wide area, the location of those dribbles, whether they are in deep or advanced areas, whether it's a long dribble, a short dribble. And I think then, as you say, the value that's added as a consequence, really, because I think we're quite clear on, if we are going to use that criteria of a take-on, is just simply going past a player. But it's that value in the seconds sort of following it, right? Rather than just necessarily that individual action. So I think we've spoken multiple times about things like possession value, expected threat, and there's more recently interesting work from StatsBomb. People will be aware of on-ball value, OBV, that they use as a model that values the action of positively or negatively of any action and its impact on the team's likelihood of scoring a goal. And there was something actually recently on Twitter that was giving the same hype to Jeremy Doku as I have on this podcast for a few weeks now, that he basically ranked third for the volume of successful dribbles. And that's interesting enough. It shows that he's quite prolific in wanting to dribble. But he was actually second in the top five European leagues last season for the dribble and carry on-ball value per 90. So that's, I think, far more interesting, that yes, it's high quantity, but the quality of those dribbles actually suggest that he's looking to advance the ball into a deeper area or a more lucrative area, rather than being what I sort of think of as a Alan Saint-Maximin, a Adama Traore, who just is a bit of a road runner but not too much end product. And I think that's where you can start to think about more deeper analytics. And the final one I'd say about is some interesting work done by Analytics FC. It's converging towards the same idea, but they basically have something called Dribble Plus, and it basically looks at the quality of the dribble plus the quality of the action that immediately followed it. So thinking about a shot, a successful pass, a chance created, whatever it may be, beyond what the action, the dribble itself was. So, you know, as I say, you could maybe beat three or four players, but then if you then go on to lose possession the fifth time, that's next to useless, even though you've maybe got your dribble stats up. So I think it's really important to look at, as you say, Ali, the quality and the value of the subsequent action or the overall action, rather than the dribble in isolation.
This sort of struck me, so I wanted to share the stats because I didn't think it would have changed this dramatically over such a short period of time. I looked at the dribble success rates on FBref across the top five European leagues going back for the past few seasons now. So currently this season, all the top five leagues are under 50% league-wide for dribble success rate. So less than half the dribbles are being successfully completed. It was also all under 50% last season. But go back to 2021-22, all of the leagues were 53% or higher. In 2020-21, they were all 56.5% or higher. And in 2019-20, were 58% or higher. So we've seen an almost 8% drop across the leagues. I wonder if that's a culmination of factors. You think surely all the good dribblers can't disappear overnight. But I think as Michael alluded to at the start, it's definitely defence is becoming better. I think it's just harder to dribble now. Fullbacks feel quicker. Teams, I think, are better at sort of channel defending. You've got the real rise of these physical centre-backs now, like a Saliba, a Van Dijk, that can pull them wide 1v1 and they're still good. So this is definitely a worse way than what Mark has done to, I think, actually analyse it. But I was just struck that you'd get such a big change, which I don't think we see normally in metrics sort of a league-wide level.
Yeah, I think there's kind of blind spots in potentially looking at success rate in isolation because of the, you know, as I say, you don't know the location of the take on itself. And this is where I started to look a little bit more at the video to see kind of what constitutes a 1v1 and a take on. And I actually looked since 2018-19 in the Premier League, I looked at the highest 1v1 success rate from any player. The highest rate was Rodri. The second highest rate was Thomas Partey. And the third highest rate was Mateo Kovacic. You know, it's obvious that we're talking about central midfielders, defensive midfielders here. That speaks to, I think, for me, the qualitative idea of a 1v1, of a dribble. It's not what we consider to be this conversation that we're having. We're most likely thinking of wide players, maybe getting to the byline or trying to get into the box, whatever it may be. But this is where you've really got to be strict with the criteria of a dribble, because in central areas where a player's maybe receiving it and maybe just pushing it past their opponent to maybe they've got more space potentially in central areas or in build-up to be able to just push the ball past someone and then, you know, spread it wide. That in theory is a take on, because there's a player trying to close them down, they're pushing it past them and they're moving the ball on. It's interesting to maybe look at the qualitative side of what we consider to be a dribble and a take on, because in that regard, it's far different. The way that Rodri takes on his opponent, far different from a Karim Mitoma, a Lionel Messi, etc.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Well, I think this is basically why I wanted to have the conversation, was to try and go through different areas of the pitch and different roles, really, and specify the different types of dribbling that are contained within that phrase, because I don't think it's enough now to say this player is good at dribbling, because it can mean so many different things, right? There are individual traits that players will have that will benefit them in certain areas of the pitch. We'll start with the obvious, and that is, as you say, like wingers, wide forwards. Here I think of pace, and I probably do think of some tricks, body feints, the sort of low center of gravity stuff that we've seen popularized by your Eden Hazards over the years. But Liam, that seems to me like the first thing that springs to mind is wingers and wide forwards. That's like classic dribbling still.
Yeah, and I think it's changing ever so slightly in terms of, we're well into the era now of the inverted winger that's gone on for an awfully long time. But you're now getting the rise of the wingers that can attack on the outside but still play on the opposite side to their dominant foot. So if you're a right footer playing off the left that can still drive to the byline and either produce a cutback with your left foot, or maybe be quick enough that you can actually get so far beyond the fullback that you've then got space to open up your body and to shoot. For me, it's all fundamentally about getting separation and getting away from the defender and being in a situation where then you can choose how you want to deliver the end product. And you're getting a lot of really, really quick wingers now. You look at Jeremy Doku, Karim Mitoma we've mentioned, but Vinicius Jr. too, Kylian Mbappe, Armand Lloriente, these real I think I'd call them two-way wingers that can go both sides. And they use what I think the best way I've seen it described is sort of a double speed. So they'll speed up, they'll slow down again, and then speed up just to basically disorientate a defender. We've seen it recently with Mbappe when he scored a few goals cutting inside and firing across into the near post against Tomori, was a stand-up one in the Champions League, where as you sort of chop in and the defender's spinning to sort of turn and trying to reorganise their feet, that you've then got that half a second to try and shoot it back through their legs. And it's becoming even more down to the margins now that they're not going to be as long dribbles as I think we're sort of used to seeing from players, where it's sort of, you know, 5-10 seconds over huge spaces. It might be over a short distance, a chop, go back on the outside. You see players faking, going one way, cutting back in, cutting again. And that's because fullbacks are, as I said earlier, so much better now that it's harder to get that. The cliche is the half a yard, right? How much space you need to provide the end product.
There's a couple of interesting wingers, I think, who can't really dribble, that I did articles on at the back end of last year, and I found that quite interesting. One of them was Harvey Barnes, who obviously is now at Newcastle. I wrote this when he was at Leicester. And I wrote this just because I noticed that he'd scored 4 or 5 goals in a single season that were kind of give and goes. He played a 1-2 and got in behind and was actually, I think, top of the charts along with Raul Jimenez and Mohamed Salah over the course of 4 seasons in terms of goals like that. But when you actually looked at his dribbling numbers, he was basically the worst in the Premier League. I mean, he was, I think, 22% dribble success percentage, which is just really, really low. And I think this was taking all the players. I think Mark did these numbers, actually. It was taking all the players who'd done or who'd attempted more than 30 dribbles in the Premier League, and he was bottom. And I found it quite interesting that he's still quite an effective player at going past opponents, despite the fact he can't actually do it himself. And the other one was in the WSL, and he was looking at the, I think by common consent, the player of last season was Guro Reyton for Chelsea. And her numbers were, I think, even less impressive. From the equivalent of 15 league games, there's only 22 games in the season, so 15 league games is a decent some. She only went past opponents 7 times. And this is a winger who is very quick, very creative, very good at providing crosses. I think of as quite good on the counter-attack. And yet she doesn't actually dribble past opponents at all. So there's clearly still room for players who are not, just good in those direct one-against-one situations.
I suppose there's an extent to which if you're the type of wide player whose delivery is the most important aspect of your game is providing crosses, is actually there's ways of creating separation, as Liam says, that aren't necessarily considered dribbles or a successful dribble, just, you know, shifting it half a yard in order to dig out an in-swinging cross or going on the outside, for example, and hanging one up. Liam wouldn't always necessarily be considered a completed dribble.
No, and on the basis of that, Mark's done some good writing on this, that we've seen how much high lines have come into the rise now. And that's because teams want to press higher up the pitch. And part of that is condensing spaces in terms of players when they receive defeat and then not having the opportunity to, you know, close it before it becomes a thing, rather than actually defending the 1v1 duel. Can you shut down the winger and try and sort of box them in so that they can't either sort of receive on the turn? There's a good clip of Arteta explaining how he likes his wingers to sort of roll inside a few yards when the fullback passes, so they don't end up with someone closing them there and they can face forward. But then on the flip side, if you're going to press high up the pitch and have that high line, you're going to leave loads of space in behind. And sometimes that quick 1-2 combination can be the way that you catch teams out when someone doesn't track a runner and they leave that space.
If I talk about the number 10 position and those that inhabit it in world football at the moment, who springs to mind when I talk about dribbling quality and ball carrying perhaps, and what qualities do they have, Liam?
I think the one that stood out for me most this season has been James Maddison. This is partly because I went to the Spurs Liverpool game, and he's one of the players that I think you appreciate him normally when you watch him, but when you see him in the flesh moving, you really get that extra appreciation for just how silky he is. The fact that for number 10 now, I think dribbles look very different. And we spoke about Jamal Musiala, who I definitely put in this category, maybe even above Maddison on the Building a Perfect Player podcast that we did. And it's having that ability to, it's really not over big distances, but it's often with pressure from behind you, that sometimes a defender literally being, you know, right up behind you and having to be a bit physical too. But it's being able to sort of wriggle both ways, that turning ability. And it's probably quite a good balance of being, you know, good physically, quick, slick and agile, and then also being spatially aware to know when to release and play the pass. I think it was when he turned Saka in the North London derby in the build-up to, I think it might be Spurs' first goal. But just those moments, especially now because of how tight defenders often go, the fact that teams man-mark in midfield, that if you can wriggle away from one player, suddenly you've split the whole system apart because someone's got to jump from elsewhere and then space gets left because they've moved. So it becomes a real case of a really good way to sort of picklock a defence, to be honest.
Hmm. Feels like being shorter can sometimes help. You know, a lot is talked about low centre of gravity, mentioned Hazard already, but particularly in those tight spaces, particularly if you're receiving the ball with back to goal, I don't know how to explain this, but it does feel like being a little shorter and having a lower centre of gravity allows you to almost like sneak around defenders who have got tight to you more easily than if Mark Carey was trying to do it at 6'4" or whatever you are.
I'll have you know, I am surprisingly agile, number one. number two, I would say that, yeah, that's a really interesting point, not least because it allows you to shift your body before you even receive the ball. So kind of as both of you say there, particularly Maddison, it's interesting that I think what he's really good at in central spaces is almost feinting as though he's going to take a touch on the front foot and then receiving it more on his back foot and kind of shifting away. I don't think in the criteria of a dribble that would necessarily constitute a take on, but it opens up space in such a good way. I think Musiala is another example of that. Art de Roche has done a piece on this about receiving on the back foot, and he's mentioned Phil Foden and Emile Smith Rowe and Saka, and Martinelli would be included in that as well. That you know, this isn't necessarily within the criteria of a dribble, but it's a really good method of, as Liam said, wriggling away from an opponent in such tight areas before you even receive the ball, and it's all about that body feint. So when I think about a number 10 dribbling, I mainly think about that, maybe a bit of off-ball stuff to create space rather than it necessarily being get on the ball and then let's take on your man.
Yeah, again, to mention this Shevchenko point, I showed him a goal where he dribbled past players and I said, you did a lot of strength work when you were young. Is that why you were so good at holding off defenders? And he said, no, it was my low center of gravity. And that got me thinking, like, I always hear this, but is low center of gravity actually a scientific thing? And I mentioned this to a couple of colleagues, and Adam Hurry had written an article about Eden Hazard where he spoke to a biomechanics expert who went into quite interesting depth about the center of gravity, which apparently is located on average at 56% of your height, which means Eden Hazard's center of gravity is 98 centimeters. I don't know whether that means anything to you, but I'd never really heard these kind of maths before.
I actually need to go back and read that. That sounds quite fascinating. There's definitely something physically in, I think it's probably a leg length thing as well, being able to take steps more quickly and turn and spin. And in terms of the plane and axis of movement that often you do get, again, I'll use an athletics example, that you tend to get smaller sprinters that over a 60 meter race will do better because they can get out the box quicker. They've got a faster foot turnover, and it is then buying that sort of first couple of yards or a couple of seconds. And I think you now get the number 10s that are really good at, when they do get away from a defender, they're really smart at sort of, they won't just attack the space, but they'll almost cut across the defender to stop them sort of recovering and putting pressure on them and say, okay, if you want to, you can foul me. And they'll sort of dribble across them, take their line, and then that just takes them out of the equation.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Before you get back to this Athletic podcast, did you know it's just one of many made by The Athletic every week? I'm Abby Patterson, senior producer here at The Athletic, and I get to work across so many of our shows. But even I have my favourites. Sometimes you're just too busy for a full-length podcast. I get it. We've all been there. Well, we've got a show to help you. Get up to speed with all the football stories you need to know about with our daily football briefing.
Stunned and dusted, Saudi Arabia will host the 2034 World Cup.
Got a bug for the women's game? Then Full Time Europe is for you. It's our dedicated women's football podcast answering the questions you're asking from the WSL and Champions League.
So what's going wrong at Arsenal?
But perhaps you want to know exactly how a team has set itself up. Then come to the audio whiteboard and join Michael Cox and our analytics gurus as they dissect and examine the game like nobody else can. That's on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast.
I don't think I've ever seen a striker who reads the game so well.
Just search The Athletic wherever you're listening to this podcast now, and you'll find your next podcast obsession in no time at all. Now, let's get back to your show.
A little deeper in the pitch is defensive midfield, central midfield, roles, Michael, where these days in particular, I feel like the concept of dribbling and its quality is crucial. Phrases like press resistance are all the rage. That makes me think of Kovacic, actually. But then power in transition is crucial in these areas too. And we're seeing that at the very top of the game.
Yeah, I think we've seen the rise of that recently. I think Arsenal fans have been really impressed with Declan Rice and how much he can kind of turn out of pressure and just drive forward 40 or 50 yards. And I think now that there's such emphasis on heavy pressing and increasingly, I think, on man-to-man pressing, if you can just spin your opponent, you've often got so much space to go into in quite dangerous situations. So Rice is very good at it. My personal favourite was Moussa Dembele, I guess most famously of Tottenham. I thought he was absolutely fantastic in that zone. I read a really good interview with him by actually one of our now colleagues, Laura Williamson, although she was working for a lesser publication then. And Dembele was speaking about the fact how when he grew up, he basically learned to play football on a pitch that didn't have goals. The game was basically just to dribble and dribble and dribble. And it was like a basketball court, I think. And you had to basically stop the ball where the pole for the basket would be. So it kind of explained why he wasn't a penetrative passer. And he never really scored goals, but he could dribble out of any situation. And I think maybe the most interesting one in the last couple of years has been Frenkie de Jong, who I guess has done okay at Barcelona. But I think when he came through Ajax, he was just so comfortable dribbling forward from almost centre-back positions that people were already speaking about him as kind of the next iteration of a great defensive midfielder. Whether that has actually been the case, I think, is debatable. But I do think there is a sense that dribbling ability now for holding midfielders just seems a lot more important now than maybe a decade ago.
And then when we talk about centre-backs, when the game moved away from just judging them on defensive traits, it felt like you needed to be good on the ball. And that initially was about your technique, really, in terms of passing and passing range, I think, more than anything. But now, you know, ball carrying, being able to have the athleticism to burst forward and break down a set defence feels now almost just as crucial as being able to play quality passes between the lines.
Yeah, and it's kind of what we were speaking about earlier in terms of where you sort of delineate a dribble from sort of a carry or being more progressive with the ball, that it's probably stepping out sort of 5-10 yards generally to bypass the first line of pressure. We see an awful lot of teams now at the very top level defending man for man in midfield. So in the same way that Michael was saying, if a central midfielder can spin someone to get away, if you can split the first line of pressure or get beyond it, and often we see teams splitting the centre backs really wide now to open that space down the sides, then I mean, one, it often forces a central midfielder then to step out and then make space sort of beyond the midfield line. And the second part, I guess, is that it just opens up so many more passing angles that, you know, if your pivot players were initially marked by, say, a front two and the centre-back can step out down the outside, then suddenly you open up the rest of the pitch. You can access the wingers, you can go into the number nine, switches come into play a lot more. It's just a big domino effect, really, and that's a repercussion of how teams have looked to press now.
I guess another difference in the dribbling between your wide forwards and some of the roles we're talking about here, centre-backs, defensive midfielders, and particularly full-backs and wing-backs as well, is the situations where dribbling comes about are very different. There's a lot more risk in losing the ball, and dribbling is generally considered quite a high-risk option. So when it comes to full-backs, wing-backs, Liam, what's specific about the way that they may need to carry, dribble the ball?
Well, I think the interesting thing I've seen with most of them now is that the full-backs tend to dribble very rarely, and their job is more to, often at the top teams, and I wrote about this last week, was to move into midfield to open that passing option actually out to the winger so that the winger can get more 1v1s. It's definitely something that Arsenal do, and Zinchenko sort of spoken about that, saying,
like Martinelli, Sané, Sterling, Bukayo, I will leave them 1v1. Mm. and as many balls I give them, if I give him 50 balls per game and I will leave him the space and 1v1, my job is done. If he didn't pass his fullback and he didn't do assist, this is not my problem. I did my job.
I guess their dribbles might end up being sort of more reactive if they do get a pass into feet and need to sort of skip away from someone, but they never sort of seem to be pre-planned as much now. I think it's a case of, okay, we'll let the wingers go 1v1 and the fullback there is okay now, and Spurs are a great example of this, is often underlapping runs. So Destiny Udogie, I think, is phenomenal at this, that every time that ball goes wide, it was Son at the start of the season, and now it's Richarlison, of he's just sprinting inside the opposition fullback and the opposition right back, and that's to, you know, take a defender away, take a midfielder away, because you need that space to be opened up for the wingers then to be able to dribble and be creative.
And up front, there are many things that go into being a striker. Michael, in the modern era, how much value is there in a striker being able to dribble versus some of the other attributes that a striker might have? And who springs to mind when we talk about number nines that can dribble?
Good question. I'm not sure who really stands out with strikers at the moment. Maybe the other two can think of someone, but I think of players probably more 10, 15 years ago doing it a bit more. Again, because I think they had more space to work in, more space in the channels to drift into. But it can be, of course, it can be very effective on the break in particular. And of course, the strikers who can come deep and receive the ball. I mean, it's an obvious thing to say, but you've got to receive the ball in order to dribble.
Yeah, I think the remit of a striker is to not necessarily have to dribble quite as much because of the nature, obviously, of their role. You know, if I were to broaden it to the 1v1 that I mentioned before, a 1v1 duel for a striker is different from a 1v1 duel for a winger, whereby they're often going to have to dribble past their opponent. A 1v1 for a striker is their opponent is going to be the goalkeeper. So I think of that as quite an interesting way to sort of look at it. And then you think about how are they going to take on the goalkeeper. It's often going round the goalkeeper. And I think that in recent years has been something of a, if not a lost art, then it seems to just be kind of going out the game a little bit more by eye. I haven't exactly got the numbers on that. But the best example I can think of is a player who was so, so good at going around the goalkeeper historically was the Brazilian Ronaldo. And if you look at his highlights reel, it just shows just how strong he was at sitting the goalkeeper down, basically with a step over, feinting, and basically passing it into an empty net. And somehow managed to find some numbers on this and found that 88 of his 414 goals involved going round the goalkeeper, which is 21% of his total goals, which is a huge amount when you think about it, of a 1v1 going round the goalkeeper, passing it into an empty net. And I just think that it doesn't feel like it's quite as prolific now. I could be wrong, haven't got the numbers on that. But if you were to think of who's the best 1v1 striker going round the goalkeeper, historically for me, it would be Brazilian Ronaldo.
I think the only sort of example I can think of that comes close to this is sort of the striker that often plays 1v2, the historic sort of Didier Drogba role, where you're almost pinning sort of, you know, the centre-back back to goal, and you're trying to spin them to get a finish away on the angle. So I guess you're technically not even sort of dribbling beyond them, but maybe round them. It's trying to get, you know, get into a position where you can phase up and shoot. And I think Mikel Antonio and Dominic Solanke are the two that really come to mind for me, as being able to do that really, really well. A really good balance of, you know, being physically strong enough to hold off some really athletic defenders now, but also then, you know, have the balance and have the awareness and the technique to finish off either foot or to push away, create half a yard. Antonio's goal against Chelsea, I think it was, is a really good example of this. It's really far from, as Mark was saying, it's really not like the conventional dribble that we've spoken about before.
There is an idea that's been perpetuated on social media. I've seen a few tweets, a few TikToks even, about this idea that the dribblers are all gone. The dribblers, as in the individualists, perhaps those that we talked about, Ronaldinho, those with tricks and flicks and skills that provided excitement. This sort of idea is that now in the modern game, wingers receive it, they cut back, they pass sideways, they pass backwards, they play safe. And attached to this idea is that Pep Guardiola is to blame because, of course, he is the most impactful modern day coach of this era. And I suppose more specifically this season, it's raised an interesting discussion when it comes to Jack Grealish and the way that he plays now compared to a few years ago, and Jeremy Doku, who they brought in the summer, in the battle between those two. So I'm interested to know what you guys think about this discussion that I've seen online about the, you know, dribbling is a dying art at elite level nowadays.
I think it's harsh to solely blame Pep Guardiola or one person. I think it's, with him specifically, is something I think you can see with Arteta and some of the others, that just when central midfielders become coaches, that they tend to be or produce teams and want their teams to play in ways that played like they were as players. And we've spoken about this on a pod that we did, in that they are pass-heavy teams. They want to control the ball. They want to play, you know, with positional play and stagger players to counter-press and to not concede transition. So I think dribbles just become, at times, too risky a part of that. Often a lot of the dribbles that you see Jack Grealish do are backwards and over distance to recycle the ball. And that is, in the Pep system, is a really effective way of dribbling. I know that Sam Lee has written about this well, and when I've spoken to him, he's become sort of quite frustrated that people don't seem to realise that the remit for Grealish is very specific, and it's to use dribbles in this way. If at times, actually, it's when the fullback stays with him and moves 15, 20 yards as Grealish dribbles inside and then switches it, the space opens up elsewhere. So I think it's not always as chaotic as people like it, and I wonder now if, especially when we're in an era of shorter form content and highlights reels, where you know you're not going to get a 4 minute YouTube compilation of Jack Grealish's safe dribbles into midfield and switches of play. It's just not quite entertaining enough. So it's definitely safe, and I think it just comes down to style more than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, on the note of style as well, I think it is dependent on the league that you're playing in. I think because of the high quality, the physicality of the Premier League, there seems to be far fewer dribblers in the typical sense. But you look at other players in other leagues, France being a good example. You know, spoke about Jeremy Doku, obviously coming straight from the French league. Bradley Barcola, obviously now at PSG, formerly Lyon. Ryan Cherki, Kylian Mbappe being examples of players who really can stretch their legs in potentially more transitional leagues. And we've spoken at length about the Bundesliga being far more transitional. And a couple of years ago, Sancho was deemed to be one of the best dribblers, 1v1 players. And it was shown just how strong he was in the Bundesliga. His strengths haven't been quite as obvious when he's playing for Manchester United, partially because of Manchester United, partially because of the league that he's playing, and he's not able to do it quite in the same way. So I think to maybe suggest that dribbling has completely gone out of the game is maybe different from maybe how it's gone out of the Premier League. And just actually on the note of Premier League, just a very quick pop quiz for everybody. You know how much I love to do this. since 2018-19, there's only one player who has attempted more than 1,000 take-ons. He's no longer in the Premier League, as a clue, as of this summer. If you give me some names, I'll tell you the top 10 as well, potentially. But there's only one player who's attempted more than 1,000 take-ons in the Premier League since 2018-19. Can you name that player?
Can I throw two names at you?
Go on.
Well, one I know is wrong, because I was going to say Raheem Sterling.
Raheem Sterling, number 4 on the list.
Okay. I didn't know if Alan Saint-Maximin has just had so many dribbles that he's actually got close to that.
Number 3 on the list is Alan Saint-Maximin.
I wondered if Riyad Mahrez might be on that list.
He's up there, but he's not in the top 10. There's another obvious one who's second on the list, who we've spoken about already, the Roadrunner.
Adama.
Adama is number 2. There's one player, the 1,000 or more, shall I tell you?
Yeah.
Wilfried Zaha, 1,001.
Of course.
Yeah. Wow.
Is the only player to take on his man, or try to take on his man, more than 1,000 times.
Michael, it seems like this idea that we've lost something in the game is broadly to do with tricks, right? It does feel like we see less of that. You know, Ronaldinho, early Cristiano, and dare I say it, Neymar, that stuff just is not that visible at the very top of the game now.
Yeah, I think it's true. And I think that probably, you know, goes back to what I said earlier, using the example of Saka and Martinelli. I think players are very efficient when they come forward. But to a certain extent, I think it's come slightly back in terms of, like, the dominant footballing ideology a decade ago was like the Spain possession model. And when you look at the players that Spain use in wide positions, they were using like Iniesta, David Silva. Like, they could, you know, particularly Iniesta could go past players, but they weren't real like outright dribblers. I'd say they were playmakers who could beat a player. Whereas now you look at, you know, the team when they've got players like Dani Olmo and Asensio and Ferran Torres and Ansu Fati. To me, it feels like, it's not that they're pure dribblers, it's just I think players are more all-rounders than they were 10 years ago, and I think most players do have that in their locker, even if they're not like, you know, Stanley Matthews figures.
And it's still, even if it's maybe not as exciting as it used to look, it's still a crucial part of the game, perhaps more so over the last few years. Liam, I kind of look at it as, you know, the Spanish 2012 model, for example, about passing and movement and breaking down defences that way. I feel like the response to that was defensive coaching becoming so much better in terms of collective shape and compactness, as we talk about a lot. But of course, dribbling and people that can go 1v1, that does boil the game down to, you know, 1v1, 1v1 contests. And there is only so much you can coach your team to deal with that.
Yeah, I think there's a degree to which, for better or for worse, it's just generally seen as not very tactical. It's a case of just sort of get the ball and try to attack the defender. And I think there's so much that happens in a dribble very quickly that, yeah, it feels like you can't always be predictive in terms of you might have a plan of attack inside, attack outside, etc. But yeah, it's just not, you know, in the same way that coaches now, a lot of them at the top, like to have patterns in some form or like to have routines, even now down to set pieces at the finest level, that, you know, they want things to be as meticulously planned as possible. And dribbling can be sort of very, very reactive, which can also then make it a really efficient strategy for certain teams, you know, when they want to play particularly transitionally and can then release those sort of wide players to attack that. It fundamentally, it just depends sort of what you want and how you want your team to play. I think there's coaches that, even as much criticism as Pep has had, that, you know, they basically recruited four dribblers over the summer in Josko Gvardiol as a centre back, in Jeremy Doku, who is probably one of the best dribblers in the world, and especially among the wingers, and then in central midfield in Nunez and Mateo Kovacic. So it's something that I think at the top level, that even if coaches want their teams to play a certain way, they won't be close-minded to, because as you say, it can win you a game out of nothing, and that is always going to be important.
I was going to say, yeah, it has its positives and its negatives. I think for the team who has dribblers in the side, it can be potentially have negative consequences in possession and out of possession. So in possession being, you know, I think there was a sort of a famous example of Cristiano Ronaldo taking on his man four or five times when he just joined Manchester United, and Ruud van Nistelrooy was getting really frustrated because he didn't know when the ball was going to be delivered. And from a manager's and the system's perspective, you want to work out your patterns. And then if you lose possession, then the player who's maybe gone on an ambitious run into maybe a cul-de-sac is then going to be out of shape for the team structure when there's transitional moments. And we've said how much, you know, those transitional moments are becoming more and more crucial within the game as well.
As is often the case with these conversations, it feels like we come back to the word control a lot, and certain managers at the very sharp end of the game being obsessed with control and controlling as much of the game as they possibly can. And dribbling by its very nature is always going to be a little bit of an enemy of that. And I'm pleased that you've told me that it's not basically being coached out of players, but maybe that dribbling is now more about efficiency than entertainment rather than being completely shunned. But Michael, do you think the sport is less entertaining as an entertainment product because we are now lacking these individualists who are empowered to be individualists? Is that a problem in your eyes for the sport as an entertainment product?
No, not really. I don't really like individualism in football. I think there's always a balance to be found between, you know, individual flair and it being a team game. But I mean, obviously, if you see Messi running through the defence and scoring a great goal, it's fantastic. But I don't particularly enjoy watching dribblers more than I enjoy watching like great passes or, you know, good combination play. There's always a balance to be found, like I say, but there's maybe some things that I don't like about the current style of football. But for me, that'd be more like the massive emphasis upon pressing, I think, is a greater issue than the fact that we don't have dribblers. And I'm not even really sure it's the case. I mean, the statistics earlier were quite interesting, but I don't think it's gone out of the game. It's just used in a different way. So no, personally speaking, it's not a big grievance of mine.
I think that it being used in a different way definitely is the best way to describe it. And it's the control thing. It's not that players can't do it or they don't want to do it or won't do it. It's the risk reward has got a lot worse to do it. And I assume as well it's because the coaches try to discourage it. And I also wonder if at the top level, dribblers tend to be more explosive profiles that just don't have as long careers. I think a Bale is a prime example of when you do run so hard and can be so intense all the time that you can't always play a lot of games. Obviously, I know we're seeing that with Saka a bit now, but yeah, I just wonder if their careers just don't last for as long, and you can't do that throughout your whole career when your pace starts to decrease.
Well, the streets will never forget Adel Taarabt, but perhaps elite-level football is leaving behind individualists. I'm really, really grateful to the guys for putting so much thought into this discussion, because I was really keen to dig deep delve into dribbling and see what we uncovered. So I hope that this conversation has given you food for thought. It certainly has for me. And we've really enjoyed doing this on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast. So do us a favor and subscribe to this podcast feed if you haven't already. We're doing things like this every week on this feed. And Michael, Mark and Liam writing fantastic stuff on the Athletic site as well. So do sign up today at theathletic.com/tactics. And join us again, please, next week on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast.
The Athletic.